CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening, I'm Carrie Baptist. In the news this week, we talked to BC Civil Liberties Association Executive Director David Eby about civil liberties concerns in the upcoming Olympics. Also, we talked to AMS VP External Tim Chu about how the AMS is planning to respond to UBC administration prohibitions on student free speech during the Games. Also, talking about a Supreme Court decision to allow political advertising on public transit. We'll have all this, plus your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101. But first, we have Kristen Lamk on the line. She's a member of the group Tap In, here to talk about the group's recent petition to the Surrey City Council to ban bottled water.
Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
Okay, so first of all, can you describe the group Tap In?
Sure. We're a group of Kwantlen Polytechnic students, and we are campaigning to convince the City of Surrey to eliminate the sale of bottled water in their municipal buildings.
So can you kind of describe what motivated you to want to eliminate bottled water?
Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons why choosing tap water is better than choosing bottled water. There's a lot of obviously, environmental impacts such as the solid waste from bottled water, the single-use bottles, and there's social issues also involved. And, you know, we don't want our water sources to become corporatized or privatized.
So can you tell me what you discovered about the bottled water that's in Surrey vending machines?
Sure. Well, the City of Surrey sells Aquafina, and Aquafina is actually bottled from Vancouver Municipal Water. And then they sell it back to us at, you know, 200 to 10,000 times the price of tap water.
So in other words, it's nothing different than what you're getting from your local water fountain.
Exactly. So, you know, actually about 40% of bottled water is actually just bottled tap water.
So can you describe the reception your group received from Surrey City Council when you asked to be able to present your ideas to the council?
Well, they didn't want us to present our ideas to council, and instead they deferred us to their Environmental Advisory Committee, which we will be presenting to this Wednesday. But basically, the mayor of Surrey, Diane Watts, she, you know, thinks that by eliminating the sale of bottled water, people will choose to buy pop, but really that's not the message of our campaign. Our campaign is to also promote the use of tap water and, you know, encourage people to use tap water as well as, you know, raising awareness because the bottled water industry has put a spin on tap water and they've convinced us that it's not safe. But really here in Metro Vancouver, our tap water is, you know, really safe to drink.
So what is your reaction to the way that Surrey City Council has reacted to you wanting to share your ideas with them?
I think we're a little bit, you know, upset because we did want to share our ideas with council, and we think that, you know, especially because of their response, our presentation would have been beneficial. It would have been great for them to hear the research we've done and the options that we're suggesting they implement.
So as you mentioned, you are speaking to the City Council Environment Committee next Wednesday. What do you plan to say to them?
Well, we're going to give them a rundown of quick facts about bottled water versus tap water. We're also going to give them an idea of how they could raise awareness about bottled water and tap water and provide information about the cost of installing water fountains and, you know, really show them that it is already part of their sustainability, their commitment to sustainability, that, you know, encouraging tap water will help them further their commitment that they have in place already.
So how hopeful are you that Surrey City Council will actually remove bottled water from public buildings?
Well, we're going in, you know, thinking positive, and we really hope that they will continue and listen to us and implement our ideas. But, of course, it'll probably be a slow process, and by checking out our website and signing our online petition, we can get more public support, which will help us convince the City of Surrey to listen to us. And our website is tap-in.ca.
Okay. Well, thank you for speaking with me tonight.
Well, thank you for having me on.
And now, to start the show off right, here's your weekly health tip with Sharon Hundle.
Your heart and your mouth are more connected than you would think. Some recent studies have demonstrated there is an association between extreme gingivitis, also known as periodontitis, and certain systemic diseases such as stroke, diabetes, and heart disease. One theory suggests that the plaque buildup on your teeth may come off while chewing, and when swallowed, these particles flow through the bloodstream. This could lead to a buildup of plaque in blood vessels, which either block blood flow or they could be oxidized by bacteria, causing damage to your blood vessel walls. So, your health tip for the day is to add a tongue scraper to your daily routine, and don't forget to brush and floss at least 2 times daily. Try asking your dentist for the super convenient floss cards, which are the size of and the shape of a debit card. You can take them with you everywhere you go, so there's no excuse. Thanks.
Thanks, Sharon. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more local news following these public service announcements.
Saturday, July 11th, the UBC Sailing Club presents Beach Party, featuring Rude City Riot at the Jericho Sailing Center. Enjoy the view of English Bay over drinks and barbecue sizzlers. Party starts at 8 p.m. Tickets available at Jericho Sailing Center, Scratch Records, Zulu Records, and the UBC Sailing Club. Come down for the naughtiest party of the summer, Saturday, July 11th.
Baby, have you got a line? Well, Nikki was so drunk, his word just came on all bounds, so she took him home with her for the night.
Street hawk tempts the huntress, let the girls go insane as we lay down our weapons, and sure enough, we are slain by that stuff.
Come check out Vancouver's very own Destroyer playing Friday, July 17th. Hosted at the Biltmore, located at 395 Kingsway, the Shilohs and Alex Sellers join Destroyer for an evening of acoustic ear candy. Doors beckon at 8, tickets available at Red Cat, Zulu, High Life, and online at ticketweb.ca. Come join our hometown troubadour, Destroyer, Friday, July 17th.
You in white, and me in grey go well tonight, so let's linger here. This used to be my favorite palm tree. I was starving in that shit house, the world.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station.
Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on.
College radio can pretty much be summed up in 5 words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa!
A plus, here I come.
It's 5:12, and the news continues on News 101. In local news, with the Olympics growing closer, it's increasingly important to make sure our civil liberties are protected during the Games. This afternoon, I talked to the Executive Director of the BC Civil Liberties Association, David Eby, about current concerns tied to the Games. So I'm talking to David Eby about UBC's recent announcement that they will prohibit students from placing signs in dorm rooms visible from the Thunderbird Winter Sports Arena. So just... generally, in your opinion, what is the intent of this policy, and is it legal? I mean, does the administration have the right to put free speech stipulations like this into student-tenant agreements?
It's a difficult situation. If UBC were a normal landlord in British Columbia, they'd be subject to the Residential Tenancy Act.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they're not. And so the clause in the RTA that says that you can't have an unconscionable term or one that's totally unreasonable doesn't apply. So UBC is distinct in that sense. And unfortunately, too, they're probably non-government for the purposes of the charter. So it really limits the recourse that students have to challenge these kinds of policies in any kind of court system or tribunal system.
So given that legal complexity, what can the BC Civil Liberties do? What can students do?
Well, I think when you're faced with a situation like this with limited legal remedies that are available, what we like to do is focus on political remedies, so using tools like media and meeting with decision makers to discuss those concerns. And we actually did have an opportunity to meet with Stephen Owen yesterday, and Mr. Owen advised us that the university would be issuing a memo that clarified the intent of the policy, and that it was certainly not their purpose to limit free speech, and that situations that we described like parody or Olympic rings with anti-Olympic messages or even pro-Olympic messages would all be permitted under this policy, that all they were concerned about were students basically engaging in commercial activity and renting out their windows to Olympics, to non-Olympic sponsors, basically.
This announcement by the university seems to fall in line with a larger trend we're seeing of limitations on free speech by VANOC and the Vancouver Police Department. Can you talk about this trend?
Yeah, we've been really disappointed by VANOC, by the Integrated Security Unit, which is led by the RCMP, and their unwillingness to stand behind Canadians' rights to free speech unambiguously. So we are getting a lot of mixed messages, and students are getting a lot of mixed messages from the security teams, from VANOC, about what is and what won't be permitted. And not just students across Canada. For example, every city along the Torch Run has been told, you should be restricting the ability of people to hand out political pamphlets during the Torch Run. And when we write to the cities and say, well, are you going to limit people's free speech that way? They write back and say, thanks for your feedback. We'll take that into consideration. Instead of saying, absolutely, free speech is super important, and it's a priority, and it's why Canada is proud to be hosting the Olympics. So, unfortunately, we haven't had the clarity that we're looking for that VANOC and the government bodies involved, including UBC, will be unambiguously protecting free speech rights. I think this clarifying memo from UBC will be one step in that direction.
Can you talk about the issue regarding protesters having to register with the Vancouver Police Department before protesting during the 2010 Olympics? Is that legal? Is this illegal? Where is the line?
Yeah, it's totally within the rights of police to say, hey, it makes our job a lot easier for planning to know how many officers we need to have on duty, to know what roads might need to be closed or not. If you come to us in advance and let us know what your route's going to be. And that's totally fine, and that's completely within their job to try to be as efficient as possible that way. Our concern is where it becomes mandatory to register with the police if you want to do a protest, especially during the Olympic period, because there is no obligation on Canadians to register their dissent with the police department before they go out and engage in free speech. Canadians have the right to go out and protest whatever they choose and on public property whenever they choose. So it's an important balance. And one that we're watching very carefully because we understand there will be a lot of pressure during the Olympic period to make sure that there aren't messy democratic things like protests going on.
Is there any way for the public and for the BC Civil Liberties Association to legally ensure that VANOC and other institutions are going to follow through on their promises with things like the installation of security cameras? Do we have a way to ensure that they're going to be taken down, or do we need to rely on political action?
Well, based on our experience with VANOC and with the Integrated Security Unit, we don't trust them. We don't trust their assurances because they've gone back on their word several times. An example of this is the security camera issue, where they were very vague about the security cameras initially. And then we were told, well, don't worry, they're all leased, they're all going back. But there might be a small handful that are left behind. And then we're told, well, actually, there'll be 900 cameras, and 50 to 70 of those will be staying behind. I mean, that 50 to 70 cameras is enough to cover a fair chunk of the downtown of Vancouver. with permanent security cameras, and we were assured that this was not going to be the case. And so we're looking to the city of Vancouver to give us the assurances that these cameras will not remain after the Olympic Games, that they will go back to where they came from.
And now, our own Megan Turcato also talked to Tim Chu, the Vice President External of the AMS here at UBC, about what the AMS plans to do to protect students' right to political expression during the Games.
Can you start by explaining what's going on with the residence contracts in regards to the Olympics next year?
Yep. So what we have is a residence contract that all students have to sign in order to receive residence from the university. And this year, because of the Olympics, what they did, the university, was they attached an appendix on the end of the residence contract. And in this appendix, it talks about the restrictions, the limitations, the implications of the Games on campus. And there's one article within the appendix that restricts signage in dormitories, and it restricts signage that is visible from the Thunderbird Arena, which is an Olympic venue, and any other overlay facilities, which is essentially just any facilities that they're using for the Olympics. And so what has happened is the university has claimed that they've put this in there to protect commercial and corporate interests for the Games, but we feel that it's written so vaguely and so broadly that it can be interpreted in a different way, and there is potential for abuse.
So what consequences could this have for students next year who are displaying maybe anti-Vanock or anti-Olympic signs in their rooms?
We don't know what the consequences are going to be because it doesn't clearly state out what the consequences will be, but there are other provisions within the residence contract that allows the university to evict you, to force you into another residence, to withhold any other services that they're giving to the student. And so what we're scared of is that this can potentially lead to students being evicted for expressing their political beliefs. And so that's the concerns, and that's where students are coming from.
So I know that BC Civil Liberties Association is also expressing concerns about this, and I just wanted to know what actions you as the VP External are taking on behalf of students.
Yeah, the BC Civil Liberties expressed concerns about this as well, and they're legal experts, so they understand that this does sort of result in a limitation to rights. So what we're doing, the AMS, is we're going to be working with the BC Civil Liberties Association in September more closely. But in the meantime, what we're doing is we're constantly raising our concerns to the university. We're also raising our concerns to the media to get the message out there that such a article in the residence contract is happening. And so what we feel is that the ball's in the university's court to actually change a lot of these articles.
What kind of a response are you getting from the university?
They have been saying that, from what I hear from the media, they've been saying that a lot of these clauses are in there because they're trying to protect commercial interests and corporate interests. And we sort of feel that that's inappropriate in a way that, because it's written so broadly, it can potentially lead to abuse.
So is there any... how would you like to see the clauses modified?
I think we understand that there is some sort of agreement between the university and Vanock, because my understanding is that Vanock sort of pressured the university to put something like that in there. So we recognize that, yes, of course, there are commercial and corporate interests that needs to be protected from ambush marketing. But at the same time, our rights and freedoms probably shouldn't be infringed upon because of protecting these commercial interests. So what the AMS would like to see is the residence contract amended to better reflect the fact that our rights can't be infringed upon.
Are you going to do any sort of awareness campaign with incoming students about what they're signing up to and what is in this contract that they're signing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one issue. A lot of students don't know that such clauses are in there. Because the residence contract is around 30 pages long, it's all legal language, it's all heavy, students hardly read it, and if they don't sign it, they won't get residences. And seeing how there's such a shortage on campus, there's around 2,000 people on the wait list, that if you don't sign it, somebody else will probably not read the residence contract and sign it. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get it out to the media, we're trying to raise this issue so students are aware of it, and what our council decided to do last Wednesday was we're going to have one of our committees look into coming up with an action plan as to what we're going to do following from the residence contract with this clause in there.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Tim.
Yep, cool. Bye.
Bye.
We're going to take another break now, coming back with international news and your weekend weather forecast here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Right to Play is an international humanitarian organization using sport and play programs to encourage the healthy physical, social, and emotional development of the world's most disadvantaged children. RTP at UBC is run by a team of committed university students who advocate sport for development, and it is the first university chapter of its kind. We want you to get involved. Together, we can educate students about sport for development, help raise money, and teach children here in the Lower Mainland about the importance of sport and a healthy lifestyle. So check us out at www.interchange.ubc.ca/RTPUBC.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Fred Durst?
He's like Iggy.
Oh, you are sorely mistaken. I
play something from $3 Bill, y'all.
What is that?
That's the landmark Limp Bizkit album.
Limp Bizkit? Oh my God! I mean,
wait, you don't agree that those are the most crucial grooves you've heard since Funkadelic?
What, Limp Bizkit grooves? Yeah, absolutely.
It's like
know.
The ultimate cross between Funkadelic and Rob Tyner.
Yeah, no, I don't agree at all.
Oh, you do not deserve a radio show.
CITR 101.9 FM, your crucial groove station.
It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS. It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. Now, in national news, today the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that political advertising must be allowed on public transit. I talked with Grace Pastine, the litigations director of the BC Civil Liberties Association, about the importance of this ruling. Today I talked to Grace Pastine, the litigation director for the BC Civil Liberties Association, about the Supreme Court of Canada's decision released today to allow political advertising on public transit. First off, how did this case get started? Was there a specific incident where political advertising was barred from public transit?
So the BC Teachers Federation sought to place some paid advertising with transit authorities. And these ads, the advertisement that the Canadian Federation of Students wanted to place was designed to promote youth voting. It was a get-out-the-vote ad. And the ad that the BC Teachers Federation wanted to place was an ad that was drawing attention to the fact that there were cuts to school funding.
In your opinion, why is this controversial? Why is it controversial to have political advertising on public transit in Canada?
Well, the transit authorities, BC Transit and TransLink, they had policies that stated that they would not accept any political advertising. They would only accept advertising for goods and services, so for commercial advertising. So they said that these advertisements were in violation of their policies.
And why is this important? What are the public benefits of having political advertising on transit?
Well, I mean, in this case, these advertisements, obviously, as political speech, this is the type of speech that goes to the very heart of the freedom of expression protections. That is, this is speech that is directly beneficial for democratic society. This case is really important for two reasons. First of all, the case has established that the government can't just contract out services and in order to escape the reach of the charter. So one of the big questions in this case was whether the transit authorities were government actors for the purposes of the charter, because, of course, as you know, the charter only applies to government bodies. And the court found that, yes, indeed, the transit authorities were government actors for the purpose of the charter, and therefore they weren't allowed to violate freedom of expression guarantees. One other important point that came out of this case, and that is that once the government creates a place for speech, they can't discriminate what kind of speech they're going to allow. So if they allow commercial speech, they also have to allow political speech.
And does this set any precedents which may have bearing on other free speech debates in Canada?
Well, what this does is just really reaffirm the principle that a government can't discriminate on the basis of content when it comes to speech. So we really see this as a win for Canadians because the court is reaffirming a basic fundamental democratic right.
And in more national news, now we have a story from Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Lorraine Chrisholm talking about the possibility of building high-speed rail in Canada.
The Obama administration announced a multi-billion dollar plan in April that identified 10 possible regions to build new high-speed rail systems as part of its economic recovery plan. They include potential links to Canadian cities such as Vancouver and Montreal from Seattle and Boston, as well as links to U.S. cities such as Detroit and Buffalo in the Great Lakes region. Parliamentary hearings began a couple of weeks ago in Ottawa into the future of high-speed rail in Canada. Paul Langan is founder of High Speed Rail Canada, and he joins me this morning from Cambridge, Ontario. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Lorraine.
High speed rail is very common in Europe and Asia, but only just getting off the ground here in North America. Why is that?
Well, I think it boils down to, after the Second World War, the North America decided to do this massive highway system. And in Europe, they said, you know, we're still going to preserve the rails and build roads. So basically, 50 years later, we're kind of so far behind the ball that our rail infrastructure cannot have high-speed rail.
Well, what does high-speed mean? How fast do the trains actually go?
Really, something over 200 kilometers an hour is what we're using as the baseline for high-speed. When you start get into your own designated track, no level crossings, no chance for car to meet train. But really, you can go up to there's routine speeds of 325 kilometers per hour in Europe in Japan that the trains do routinely.
Well, so at that speed, it'd probably take, I guess, about an hour to get from Vancouver to Seattle.
Yeah, the proposals we can talk about, you know, Amtrak has their plan through the Washington State government, their plans on the website, what they want to do, and so, you know, you guys have, there is a plan out there. It's not like you have to do all the studies, and the plan's already been done.
Now, you mentioned that we haven't sort of kept up to date with our rail system in Canada, and the infrastructure isn't up to carrying trains traveling at that speed. What would it take to start supporting high-speed rail through the infrastructure?
Well, it depends on, you know, what that high speed they want to do. If for instance, if they want to do higher speed, so for instance, Seattle to Vancouver right now, I think the fastest it goes is like 115 kilometers per hour. But, you know, if you want to increase that to like 190 kilometers per hour and really cut down your time substantially, that plan is there. If you wanted to go to the next step, which is totally new track, totally, like I said, designated corridor, that would take a significant amount of investment and studies. But then you can go into the 200, 300-kilometer range. But certainly there's things that the BC government can do or the federal government can do on the Canada side of this to play massive catch-up right now.
What kind of route lends itself to high speed rail? Would it, for instance, would Montreal to Vancouver be a candidate for that?
Well, you know, really, you do have to have a certain kind of population density along it to make it make sense. Not to say that our east-west trains in Canada don't need to be modernized and have faster trains, but really for a true high speed, the actual Vancouver to Seattle or Portland corridor is a good corridor for because of population densities. Now, you're quite correct, though, it's as curvy as you get, and for high speed, you know, it's basically straight. But again, there's a lot of variation between true, very high speed and where you're at now. You can go a long way with the improvements that Amtrak and Washington State have already suggested, you know, such as taking down some of them curves and such.
How does rail compare with planes and cars when it comes to emissions?
Well, you know, that's always the selling point about rail is that it's one-fifth of the pollution that a car would put out or that one-third of what an airport does. So that's the selling point about rail from the green side is the environmental stuff, the carbon dioxide reduction from the greenhouse gases is significant. Just the whole thing, if you get off the oil dependency, is significant. If you go electric, and then, of course, if you go electric, you have to determine the source of the electricity. But these are the kind of things. The environmental footprint from high-speed rail is just at the beginning when you're putting it in. Of course, if you're just improving existing track, it's a very small environmental footprint. But as far as the environmental footprint after, it's far superior than the automobile and paving BC and like we're doing and paving the rest of Canada and building the airports.
What about cost from the perspective of a consumer? The biggest competitors right now are the airlines. Will people take trains if flying is cheaper?
No doubt about it. I just saw a thing the other day in Europe where they put in a new line and it used to be one-fifth of the people took the traditional train instead of the plane, and now half the people are taking the high-speed train. People take it. There's no doubt about it. Those studies have been done in Europe. It's pretty well, you know, not even an arguable factor. In fact, the airlines in France are starting to buy the high-speed companies up because they see for, you know, short hauls under 800 kilometers, it's the way to go. The only thing that happens here in Canada that we run into is the airline industry says they're going to be wiped out, so we can't have modern rail. So we're the only G8 country in the world that doesn't have modern high-speed rail because we're scared that our airline industry controls how people travel, which is pretty bizarre because, as we know in the rest of the world, people can go by road, people can go by air, or people can go by rail.
Now, the biggest holdup in a car or a bus when you're going to Seattle is actually the border. How would a train service handle that?
Well, you know what? This is where we get away from the train, the technology is not the problem. This is when we get into the bureaucracy, the politics is the problem. And I'm so aware of this because in my own lifetime, I've seen Windsor to Detroit, Michigan be taken away. And then just recently, about 5 years ago, they took away the train from Toronto used to go to Sarnia and Port Huron, Michigan, and they took away that too. And part of it was this post-9/11 fears that we have. So these problems are entirely solvable. So one of the problems you have in Vancouver right now is that second train, and it's been well publicized that the Canadian Border Services Agency, the federal government, won't pay for the customs there. And truly, it's ridiculous. I mean, this question doesn't come up when you're crossing road bridges between Detroit and Windsor or between any other corridor. They just add more lanes and add more booths for the customs. So that's a great example of how government, in this case, is stopping service from being increased in your area for just a ridiculous reason. The amount of money was, I think, $1,500 a day. And compared to the billions and billions, I mean, they just spent $4 billion for the auto industry that just went bankrupt.
Now, we know, Paul, that there is some political will. The Obama administration's interested. Mayor Gregor Robertson of Vancouver is interested. How much interest is there at the federal level in Canada?
The missing link is the vision from the federal government, and that's significant. So when you talked about President Obama, that's what kick-started the whole American revival. In Ontario, Quebec, the mayors, the provincial premiers are all on board. I mean, we put on these public symposiums, and, you know, we have a hard time keeping up with the cities that want us to do it. And in B.C., a little different there. You definitely have your mayor on board 100%, as you mentioned. I haven't got that warm, fuzzy feeling from your provincial government. So, but certainly 100%, that's the missing link. But it doesn't mean that that vision can't happen or be changed. Well, that's what we're working on, is trying to get the critical mass of people to say, hey, we're excited about high-speed rail. I think it's time for the government and power to get excited.
Well, it's been good talking to you this morning, Paul.
No problem at all.
I've been speaking with Paul Langan. He's the founder of High Speed Rail Canada, and he joined us this morning from Cambridge, Ontario.
And now to CKUT, talking with Yves Engler about his book, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy.
One of the few pillars of Canadian national identity is our perceived role as both a peacekeeper and peacemaker around the world. It is Canada's darker side that author and activist Yves Engler scrutinizes in The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, a thick account of this country's foreign policy record, one that seriously challenges the perception of Canada as a force for good in the world. In fact, Yves Engler's book is a reality check about Canada's role on the world stage and a shockingly dirty laundry list of our activities abroad, from Africa to Asia to Latin America to the Middle East. I had the opportunity to speak with Yves Engler for Citizenship.
The book really comes out of my role in the Haiti Solidarity Movement after the Canadian government helped overthrow Haiti's elected government in February 2004 and supported a brutal dictatorship that killed thousands of people. In working against Canadian policy in Haiti, or learning about Canadian policy in Haiti, I was really taken aback to the extent which the Canadian government participated in this real imperial crime against the Haitian people. So after the worst of the political repression in Haiti subsided, I decided to look at whether Canada had acted in similar ways elsewhere. So I guess going into the Haiti Solidarity Movement, I was fairly naive about Canada's role in the world. You know, I knew that there was a history of dispossession of First Nations people, that there was a class dynamics within Canadian society, but I certainly didn't think that Canada acted in the same way as Washington does. And so the Haiti Solidarity work really opened my eyes up to that. Secondly, while participating in the Haiti Solidarity Movement, we found that many Canadians had a hard time believing what we were saying the Canadian government was doing in Haiti. People would have a hard time believing us when we said that the Canadian International Development Agency was financing a highly partisan Haitian human rights organization that was basically concocted lies to justify the imprisonment of the constitutional prime minister, the constitutional interior minister. And so Canadians really would have a hard time believing what we were saying was taking place in Haiti. And so to understand a bit more about this myth of Canada as a force for good in the world and this sort of mythology that we have as Canadians that our country is the peacekeeper, the idea of, you know, Lester Pearson and the Nobel Peace Prize, and there's this really serious mythology in this country that Canada is a force for good in the world, and actually numerous studies suggest that Canadians have the highest self-appraisal of their country's role in the world. So the point of this book is really to look at this myth of Canada as just a do-gooder around the world.
Why do you think this view exists in terms of viewing Canada as a force for good in the world? Why does this view widely exist in Canadian society? It certainly does. Where is it coming from if actions are so different from that idea that Canada in fact is a force for good? If our actions around the world are so different from that, why does it exist so widely across Canada?
The first reason, I think, is that Canada didn't officially have colonies. Leaving aside the process of colonization internally, unlike many or most European, Western European countries or Japan, Canada never officially had foreign colonies. Mm-hmm. In fact, that wasn't for a lack of trying, where the Canadian government actually tried to annex the British Caribbean at the early 1900s. But I think the mythology in the more current phase is really tied to peacekeeping and Lester Pearson. And I think really the brilliance of someone like Lester Pearson and the whole UN peacekeeping that he sort of brought onto the stage, was that it was really actually advancing U.S. geopolitical interests in the context of the Cold War, but he was able to spin that as benevolent peacekeeping that was about, you know, sort of saving the children. That was a sort of line that was put forward. The Canadian government has played this sort of good cop role to the bad cop U.S. for much of the past 50 years. Canada really sort of takes on these types of foreign policy endeavors that are sort of really packaged in high-minding sounding ways, such as peacekeeping or today with stuff like the responsibility to protect. So I think that the mythology really comes out of that, and also it comes out of the fact that the Canadian left has been really sort of caught up in this sort of left nationalist explanation of things, which is that Ottawa is forced to do bad things because Washington, the big bad Americans, pushes into it, not that there is actually a class structure or there's an elite within Canada that benefits from empire and Canada's role in that empire.
Canadian peacekeeping as supporting U.S. policy in the global south. I think that for a lot of people, that's something that's would be hard to believe. So Lester Pearson is a hero to many. Why do you put forward such a strong critique of peacekeeping as we understand it in Canada? Give us an example to explain what that means.
Modern peacekeeping is popularly understood to have begun with the Suez Crisis in 1956 in Egypt, when the British, French, and Israelis invaded Egypt. And what peacekeeping comes out of is actually the fact that Washington opposed that invasion, and Washington opposed the British, French, Israeli invasion for two reasons. One, because Washington was telling France and Great Britain that they were no longer the players in the Middle East, that there was a new power on the stage, that being Washington. And secondly, Washington opposed the invasion because they were worried that it added to Moscow's prestige among Arab governments. Lester Pearson worked hand-in-hand with the U.S. government to come up with the idea of the U.N. peacekeeping mission to Suez that ultimately came about. But Pearson's motivation for this peacekeeping mission was not to defend Egyptian sovereignty, was not to defend Egyptian civilians from being harmed. It was to defend U.S. geopolitical interests in the Middle East, full stop.
But civilians certainly were protected by the peacekeepers, Egyptian civilians.
For sure. And in the case of the Suez peacekeeping mission, the effect was relatively benevolent. In the case of the UN mission to the Congo, where the peacekeeping mission in 1960 to 1964 ultimately helped kill Patrice Lumumba, the Congolese independence leader, that was one of the serious crimes of the latter half of the 20th century, and helps explain in large part, or in part, why the Congo is so poor and messed up today. Canada participated heavily in that UN mission in the Congo. Likewise, the situation in Haiti is it's a UN mission that oversaw or consolidated the U.S. French-Canadian invasion that helped oust Haiti's elected president in February 2004. And a UN mission in Haiti supported thousands of Haitians being killed in a horrible campaign of political repression after the coup d'etat. Canadian foreign policy is basically motivated by two things. One, support for empire, historically the British Empire, today the American Empire. And that's not support for empire just for the sake of it or because those empires forced Canada or Ottawa into doing it. It's because the Canadian elite see empire as beneficial to their interests. Concurrently, Canadian foreign policy is motivated by supporting Canadian corporate interests abroad, despite the effect those corporate interests have on communities, whether the effect is benign or whether the effect leads to serious human rights violations. Canadian diplomacy, Canadian High Commission, Canadian embassies, Canadian trade offices around the world are working on a day-to-day basis to advance Canadian corporate interests, no matter their effect on the local populations.
If Canadian foreign policy today in many places throughout the global south is based on that relationship between governments, officials, the Foreign Service, and corporations, what do you feel Canada should be doing as an alternative to our policy be driven by corporations?
The first thing is the Canadian government should no longer support overthrowing elected governments as it did in Haiti in 2004 or the Salvador Allende government in Chile in 1973. One proposal I put forward, the Canadian Army should never be sent abroad unless there is a resolution of the entire UN General Assembly, not just the Security Council, which peacekeeping missions are actually under the control of, but the entire UN General Assembly. I think we should be significantly reducing the Canadian military budget. For me, above all else, the situation of Canadian foreign policy is so rotten that we have to work to reduce the amount of bad that Canada is doing in the world before we can move towards a situation of really concerning ourselves with sending aid teams or sending doctors around the world or different kinds of sort of charity-esque adventures. I think that what we need to do here in Canada is build a movement of critical consciousness towards Canadian foreign policy. So Canadians don't just take what politicians say they're doing around the world at their word, and that people actually look at the effects of the policy in a more critical way. And until we get to a point where we seriously democratize Canadian foreign policy, because ultimately Canadian foreign policy is shaped by this foreign policy establishment that's made up of the military generals, some military contractors, the big mining companies, the banks, a handful of politicians. The majority of Canadians have very little influence over this country's foreign policy, and I think that it's imperative that we work to democratize foreign policy and to build a movement that takes what Canada's doing in the world, takes it seriously, and works to orient that towards a more just policy.
So the situation in regards to Canadian foreign policy, could it change simply through an altercation of that policy, or does there need to be fundamental political change in the country?
First of all, I think that there's very little difference between the major political parties on foreign policy. Really? So on that plane, I think that the NDP provides a slightly more just version of Canadian foreign policy. But there are numerous examples where the NDP is totally supportive of the establishment, be that support for Israel historically, be that even the more recent case of Haiti. There are examples like Afghanistan where the NDP provides a better alternative. Okay. Secondly, I think that too many Canadians concerned with the world allow themselves to be co-opted by the state regarding foreign policy. So you have a history of something like CUSO, the Canadian University Services Overseas. We have young Canadians who are sort of internationally interested. Instead of fighting to build a social movement in Canada against Canadian policy around the world, instead would go to other countries to help teach or to help build a school. And to me, that's really the mistaken conception of the problems in this world. And the problems in this world are largely that countries in the global south where poverty is rampant, is that those people are being put into that position by political forces.
And is Canada one of them?
And all too often Canada is one of those forces.
You've been listening to an interview with Eve Angler, author and activist, who recently published the Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy. This interview has been produced for Citizen Shift by Stefan Christoff.
Thanks to Co-op Radio and CKUT for those pieces. We're going to take another break, but stay tuned for weather next here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a non-profit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Yeah. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist, coming to you live from the Student Union building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. It's now time for your weekend weather forecast, and here's Sharon Hundle.
Here's your weekend forecast for July 10th to July 13th. Temperatures are rising again as a ridge of high pressure continues to dominate over the west coast of British Columbia. Friday evening to the overnight will be clear with a low of 14 degrees. Saturday, the sun will be out in full force with a daytime high of 25 by the water and 30 degrees inland. Sunday, we might see a change in the afternoon. The day will start off sunny, but it will become increasingly cloudy by the afternoon with a 30% chance of showers. Sunday's daytime high is 26 by the water, 31 inland. Monday, mix of sun and cloud, it'll start to cool down a bit with a daytime high of 22. That's your weather this weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC.
And thanks to Alice Wong for providing that forecast. That's our program for July 10th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Toccato produced this radio program. Join us next Friday at 5 for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Carrie Baptist, and thanks for listening. Coming up next is Hot Mess. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.